Hi, I'm Connie Loizos.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Happy Friday. We're back. This week with an interview with Eric Law, a general partner with IVP who's been with a growth stage firm for more than 13 years, and who recently moved from his longtime base in Silicon Valley to London, a move his young family is enjoying, he says, and that's also giving him a better view into IVP's portfolio companies in Europe, including Klarna in Stockholm and the open source platform Ivan, based in Helsinki. We talked about IVP's newest fund, succession at the firm, which is a tricky issue right now for a lot of firms that were founded around the same time as IVP, which launched in 1980. And we also talked about what the market needs to see right now for a private company to go public and also not see its shares fall immediately afterward once it does. Eric is a straight shooter. I really enjoy talking with him. Hopefully you'll enjoy the chat too. In the meantime, I had a great time this week also visiting with numerous other investors at a San Francisco event hosted by the powerhouse accelerator Y Combinator, which just staged its most recent demo day event. These demo days, as many listeners will know, bring together the newest startups that YC has helped hone with VCs who are forever looking for the next big thing. On Wednesday night, in fact, they brought together the two camps over drinks and past hors d'oeuvres in a 38,000 square foot building into which Y Combinator moved just about 6 months ago, I'm told. And it was packed and it was buzzing. And no one seemed all that interested in leaving by 8 p.m. when it was supposed to end. I completely lost track of time. Though unfortunately, this is not uncommon for me, as Alex will readily tell you. Either way, I'll have a little more color from the evening in TechCrunch's weekend newsletter, which hits readers' inboxes every Sunday morning. You can also tune in to the TechCrunch podcast Equity, which did a really fun, entertaining recap titled YC2 IPO earlier today. There was a lot of talk about AI at the event, as you might imagine. Bigger picture, the night really felt very much like San Francisco pre-pandemic. People are out again. There's renewed energy. There's no shortage of things that the city needs to fix around these parts, but things are moving again in the right direction, which isn't something that you see in news accounts about the city. Anyway, on to that interview with Eric. Hope you enjoy it. I'm really happy to be talking to you today about a bunch of things. I mean, first of all, of course, congratulations on the new fund. I'm sure that's always a relief to get something closed. Of course, you probably, you have like a break of like a few months and then you start fundraising again.
Well, first, thank you. And we definitely appreciate the support from our LPs and don't take it lightly. And while it was sort of never truly in doubt, I sort of joke, you know, an investment firm with no capital is not of much use to anybody. So it's nice to know that you can take that off the table. But one of the things that I think is a trait about our firm that maybe isn't as popular these days is we're pretty disciplined in our fundraising strategy. So maybe, again, old-fashioned, but we raise one fund that all of our team works out of, including those of us who are in California or New York or Europe. It's just one fund, one team, and we raise it every 2.5 to 3 years. So it is great to get it done. While I certainly enjoy and appreciate the time with my LPs, I am glad that we can put that to the side and we can turn all of our attention to finding investments to fill it out.
Yeah, I bet. Can I ask, was the fundraising process any more or less difficult this time around? I mean, there are a lot of LPs who were for at least a long period of time, the market's come back, but were pretty stretched and sort of over-allocated suddenly.
Yeah, I think it was a choppy period throughout. I mean, and if you really rewind the clock, you know, back, I'd say 2018, when we raised the prior fund, Fund 16 for us, was kind of what I'll call a quote unquote normal environment. We raised a slightly bigger one in 21, which was clearly not a normal environment. But I do think one thing we are glad we didn't do was raise an excessive amount of capital relative to our strategy and then deploy it all very quickly, which other folks in our industry did. And so when we looked at raising this next fund, again, 2018, 3 years is 21, 3 years is 24. So it's pretty consistent. We just said, look, this is the right amount of money we need for our strategy. And we have a saying in our firm, which is have your strategy dictate your fund size, not the other way around.
Right.
And I think that resonated.
Eric, I wasn't planning to ask this, but I am curious. Did you take any money from Saudi Arabia? I just know that that's sort of become more acceptable, more widespread. Wondering if that's a new or existing LP.
We don't typically comment on our LP base, but we don't have capital from that region.
Okay. So you're talking to me from San Francisco. You have 2 degrees from Stanford. You were in the Bay Area forever. How did you wind up in London? And when did you make that move exactly?
So working backwards, moved just end of last summer. And you've done your homework. I have actually been in the Bay Area since I was 18 when I came to Stanford for undergrad. But I think for us, the expansion to Europe was really an organic sort of extension of a strategy we'd been pursuing. And so we actually made our first investment in Europe back in 2006 in Helsinki, Finland, in a company called MySQL, which was acquired subsequently by Sun for $1 billion when that was not run of the mill. So a really good outcome. In 2014, we became an investor in Klarna. And subsequent to that, we've actually got quite a bit of our portfolio over there. And our European portfolio today is about 20 companies or so. It's about 20% of our active portfolio spread over 10 different countries. And it's worked out really well for us. And we decided that as we think about the next 40 plus years of our firm's history, we're more bullish on the European opportunity than we ever have been, and felt like actually doing an expansion in 2023 and putting some feet on the ground was the right move for our firm. In terms of my personal decision to move over there, I mean, the business reason made a lot of sense. I actually have been involved in, I don't know, plus or minus half of the European investments already anyway. And from a personal perspective, I thought it was a fun adventure to try something different. And my kids are 12, 10, and 6, so they have a chance to live abroad. My wife enjoys traveling. She obviously has a very important say in a decision of that magnitude.
That's really great. I always wished that we could have spent some time abroad with our kids. I think it's amazing to think like where you can go on the weekends too. You know, I do have to ask quickly, Klarna, so much drama. What did you make of the information reports about, you know, Michael Moritz versus the partner whose name I'm forgetting, who was on the board representing Sequoia and is now no longer doing that? Andrew Reed is on the board.
Yeah, Matt Miller. You know, so we are smaller investors in Klarna. We are not active in the board discussions. You know, I think in many ways they've had the sort of worst of both worlds. They file publicly, they're subject to a lot of scrutiny. Everyone sees their numbers, but they, you know, don't have the currency. Mm-hmm. I think Sebastian is now much more open about the fact there'll be a public entity at some point in the not too distant future, which we're excited about. The reporting, I guess, if accurate, I can't get behind the motivations. I don't know exactly what happened, but I'm just glad that they put it behind them and can focus on the business.
Yeah. Well, I always think these sort of succession things are interesting, which we're going to talk about, by the way. But I did want to ask, too, just about, you know, we haven't done an event in Europe since 2019 when I sat down with Sebastian on stage in Berlin. And obviously, TechCrunch has a big staff in Europe covering the scene there. But for me personally, you know, I'm wondering what you're seeing in terms of how founders there are different, if at all. I mean, I know there used to be much more sort of risk aversion, institutional aversion. Are you seeing noticeable differences, or do you think, you know, that's not the case anymore?
Well, I'd say compared to the first 10 years of my career, there has been a big difference. And that's one of the reasons we find it more interesting to be over there now. I think that in the sort of, again, first 10 years, the aspirations, self-confidence, ambition of European entrepreneurs, frankly, wasn't that great. And I think they're more content with a lower ceiling on what they thought they could accomplish. I think you then had a number of entrepreneurs, people like, you know, Daniel Ek at Spotify and Ilka at Supercell and Sebastian at Klarna, Tavi and Christo at Wise, Daniel at UiPath, I'm sure I'm forgetting some others. But this group, this cohort of entrepreneurs sort of said, why should we limit ourselves? And, you know, I'm not going to be content building a company that's just the best in my country or even my continent. I want to build a global leader. And now that they've proven that they have been able to do it, It actually is inspiring the next generation because they are now role models. And in many ways, it's a lot like what you saw happen in Silicon Valley in the 80s and 90s, which is one of the reasons we're more excited about where the opportunities will come from.
Is it still the case that VCs in Europe encourage founders to get to the US as soon as possible?
I don't know as soon as possible, but I think in that same vein of big markets and going after them, you can't really ignore the size of the US market or tech companies in particular. What we are seeing and where I think we slot in very nicely in the development of European-based companies is as an investor focused really on Series B and Series C rounds and really that growth and expansion stage. Our experience has typically been, you know, a seed round might be done by a local firm. And if it is not based in England, the language of the company and the board meetings is probably in French or German, whatever the respective country may be. If they get some traction, a Series A may be done by sort of a pan-European firm. And the language typically switches to a common one, which fortunately in our case is English. And then by the time, you know, they think about raising a Series B, they're 5, 10, 15, 20 million of revenue. There's a path and visibility to keep executing and doing what they're doing and being successful in Europe. But geographic expansion is a multi-year initiative. And that's when they also tend to start thinking about how do I get to this big market in the US? And they want to do that with the help of a US-based investor. And we come in very nicely at that stage and are very collaborative with the existing investors as well.
You mentioned investments all over the continent, Finland, Turkey, Stockholm. I did wonder if, you know, based in London, it became known over time for producing strong fintech and AI companies. It feels like that's kind of still the case.
I think the way I would think about it is the entrepreneurs in a given city tend to solve problems that they see around them. And in the case of London being such a strong financial hub, there definitely are more fintech companies. I'd say we say in Germany, for example, a lot of companies that are developing software products, maybe their first target customer industry is in manufacturing because they still do a lot more of it than, mm-hmm. you know, than we do over here. So you see a little bit of that. I would say the French market seems to be more evenly distributed in terms of application software, certainly some AI we're seeing, but also some consumer businesses as well. And you, so you do see some of those hubs. And I would argue that that is actually not that different from the way the New York ecosystem evolved as well.
You mentioned AI. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. Mistral, Hugging Face founders, French. Mm-hmm. Oh, Be Real also in France. You mentioned consumer, which brought this to mind. That company is apparently either looking for funding or looking to sell. I'm wondering, have you kicked the tires on that company?
We've researched them, spoken to them in the past, and we aren't currently investors. So I don't have a lot of visibility into what their current strategy is.
It's just interesting. I think it says it has 25 million active users, which is huge. And yet it seems like it's flailing. I just feel like the window is so short for something to happen here.
Yeah, I think social is hard. The prize is massive. The path to get there is pretty hard. I do think every few years, you know, companies have been able to establish a foothold, even with the strength of Facebook/Meta. I mean, you know, Snap continues to have a strong pull, which we invested in pretty early on. Discord has carved out some space in the market for themselves. Obviously, TikTok has done something pretty transformational. So the prize is big, but it's hard to get there. I mean, that's part of the challenge of the fund investing in consumer apps, which we've done, is which of these rocket ships actually have enough fuel to sort of break through the atmosphere and which ones kind of come back down to earth.
Right. It's so hard. Well, you know, so speaking of that, you have personally been involved in such a range of companies at IVP, from Glossier, which we were talking about earlier. I guess at the later stage where IVP invests, is it all about the numbers?
Well, I would clarify. I mean, later stage, I bristle a little bit. I think we're looking for growth and expansion. Mm-hmm. Numbers are present, so we definitely evaluate them. But our thought process is really kind of what we talked about in terms of the consumer apps. These companies are rocket ships, but is there enough there in their product vision, in their addressable market, that they could actually become a really big business? And I've been fortunate and lucky to work with some businesses that have sort of broken through that atmosphere and gone out into space. This analogy we're probably butchering and taking the death at this point. But I think one of the things we look for as a firm are those ingredients. Can they get to scale? Are they going after a big enough market? We don't really like investing in sort of more niche-y solutions because you just don't get to be a big company. And the other thing, this is definitely a little bit more qualitative as opposed to some of the points you made around metrics, but I just like to ask, is this company solving a real problem for somebody?
And so Glossier, what problem was Glossier solving? Because it is a cosmetics company, essentially.
Yeah, well, I think they have a message that resonates, which is really being more comfortable in who you are. And I think that's a little bit different in particular from the way that women have been marketed to over the years in that industry, which is almost a subtle making you feel like you're not enough. Mm-hmm. And that's why you need our product. And mm-hmm. this more, our approach is, you know, lighter weight, not quite as flashy or bold in the colors, unless you want it to be. We have a range. And we have a range of, for example, shades that are designed to make every skin type feel included. And that's part of our core values. And I think that was and is a gap in the market that is authentic to Glossier's values.
I think it just also underscores, obviously, the importance of great storytelling. Anyway, moving on. So we talked for a second about Klarna and that little kerfuffle, which I don't know if it's fair to say that was sort of ties to Succession with Mike Moritz leaving the firm. But I did want to talk a little bit about Succession at IVP. I've always thought the firm is so interesting. Fortune covered your new fundraise, and it mentioned, you know, that Reed Dennis, who founded the firm, didn't name the firm after himself, but yet it also mentions that there are pictures of him all over the firm. You know, Norm Fogelstein, a former programmer at Hewlett Packard, who I've talked to in the past, is still very prominently listed on the website as an advisor. Todd Chaffee, same thing. IVP talks about making room for its younger partners, but I do sometimes wonder if that's actually happening.
Oh, I would say without question, it's happening. We've had the good fortune of being in business since 1980, to your point, as Reed had started the firm. And, you know, I think we've also had to adapt and, no pun intended, but build an institution that outlasts any single one of the general partners. We have a strong culture and tradition of providing people in their careers the opportunity to move up in the organization to the highest echelons of the general partnership. I'm fortunate to be an example of that. Many of my partners are as well. It's not exclusively the path at the firm, but it's a real opportunity that people have. We don't have a managing partner. We don't have a CEO. And, you know, we've had people enter the firm, serve the firm and our LPs, and also as they get to a different point in their lives and careers, sort of take a step back and move on to different things, which by definition does create more room and responsibility, importantly, for what people who were younger and now are reaching sort of that prime age in their careers to help carry the institution forward. And I think we're really proud of that.
You know, I ask because obviously so many firms are in the same situation as IVP. They were founded in the early 80s, and there's a level of GP, MD that's moving out. And in some cases, it's sort of like they were never connected to the firm. And in other ways, they're still, you know, very much advisors. KP also counts, you know, John Doerr and Bing Gordon as advisors, for example. Can I ask, do Chaffee and Fogelstein still receive carry?
You can ask, but I don't want to get into the inner workings of along that dimension. So I'll politely decline. But I'd say we do value their inputs and advice and their contributions to the firm over many years.
When you say there's no CEO, so there's no like top banana, there's no managing director.
We have multiple managing directors, actually.
I mean, right. But there's no structurally,
but no, we actually don't have a CEO. We don't have a managing partner. When our GP group gets together to opine on investments, it's one person, one vote. No one's got a veto. No one's got a silver bullet. You need a supermajority of support amongst your partners to move something forward. And that's true whether you've been a GP for one fund or if you've been a GP for five, which is a really important part of our culture. We even think about and take that approach to the way that we manage the organization in terms of working closely with what we call our ELT or our marketing, finance, and IR leaders, et cetera. We actually rotate the responsibility amongst the GP group, so everyone has some visibility and connectivity. Mm. And it maybe is idiosyncratic, but it works well for us.
That's great. You know, also Norm told me a decade or so ago that IVP was sort of, you know, always focused on an apprentice model. And I wondered if that's still true.
I think that does speak with the promote from within model that we have. And so we also, in the same rotation, we have our general partners mentoring our mid-career junior professionals. Mm. And that rotates every 6 months so that you get a breadth of experience across the firm, work with different people, different styles. And that was in place when I joined the firm, and that was 13 years ago.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's smart. Okay, so let's just talk quickly. There's obviously a valuation reset going on for every company, seemingly, that's not a large language model company, which is a lot of companies.
I'm glad you threw that exception in there because I was going to make the same point.
So I was going to say, you know, in some ways that gives you easier access to top companies, but in other ways, I'm guessing it hurts you because some of your existing portfolio companies have got to be, you know, getting impacted themselves. So tell me like what you're seeing essentially and how you're navigating through this.
In terms of companies that are raising money, the ones that are most promising will always have choice and there will always be competition for those rounds. And thus the rounds and the valuations associated with them will always feel expensive. No one ever, I think, reached a great venture outcome feeling like, man, I got a steal on that deal. Mm-hmm. You always feel like you're slightly uncomfortable, if not very uncomfortable, but the belief in what the company could become overcomes and offsets that feeling of slight discomfort. And that's part of the fun of the job. So in terms of that discomfort level, however, it is definitely less intense and excessive than it was in 2020 and especially 2021. Obviously, I'm sure you've covered this a lot with your listeners, but the capital environments have changed a lot. A lot of the excess capital and tourist capital in the venture industry has retreated to, you know, I guess, more comfortable territory for some of those folks, which I think in the long run is a good thing for the ecosystem. I know it may sound self-serving, but I kind of believe that companies can suffer from starvation, i.e. not having enough capital, but also from indigestion mm-hmm. and being overfed, which was clearly the case the last 2 years. So I think we're in a more normalized environment, but I would also say that probably the statistics would suggest that the deal activity is also, quote unquote, down, certainly down from 20 and 21. But that's because companies have really gotten more efficient. They realize that capital isn't free. There's not a guarantee you'll get your next round in 6 months at a, you know, 3x the price of the last round without having made progress. And so there's much more of a refocus on the milestones it takes to build a company over time.
Sure, sure. In terms of companies, though, who maybe are suffering from indigestion because there was so much money being pushed at them and seemed to be sort of like the widespread advice was take it while you can. Where are we in the cycle of things in terms of people just kind of saying, okay, I'm going to take a down round here, or I'm going to put off another round because I've got a little more runway. I've kept hearing last year that this would be the year, but I think I'm still not seeing as many, I guess, down rounds as I thought would be the case.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if maybe next year is the year that we really see much more on this front.
I think there's more to come. I think you see some high profile ones like a Cameo, for example, that mm-hmm. you know, had a pretty significant change to their valuation if the reporting is correct and we're not investors. The observation I have is just like many times people don't know what they are capable of until their backs are against the wall. I think the same is actually proving true for companies. They may not have thought they could be as efficient with their engineering team or their sales team or their marketing dollars as they are proving they can be because mm-hmm. they realize there may not be the opportunity to raise more. And that's sort of resulted in the extended runway that has delayed, in some cases, the conversations that you would expect to be resulting in down rounds. There are also some companies that have just gotten profitable and don't need to raise money because, you know, once you are profitable, you control your own destiny. Those companies raise money again or exit prior to another fundraise. That's possible. Will some continue to grow and potentially go public, which of course is also a fundraising event? I think we'll see that too. But on that last point, with the market being as choppy as it is, and maybe Reddit will change things, I think a lot of companies that have the capital, maybe in excess of amounts left over from 21 era fundraises, are just waiting for a more opportune time to go out.
What do you think the threshold is for going public right now? I saw that Rich Wong of Accel sees it as around $250 million in revenue annually, which seems high. Is that accurate?
I think that's probably a floor, to be honest with you, in my opinion at this point. And I think even another 100 or 150 million on top of that would give you a little bit more buffer.
Wow.
Just because the markets are volatile, you want to be big enough where even if it's not because you missed a quarter, let's say something happens geopolitically or something like that happens, you know, maybe there's election volatility, that you don't sort of get a third of your market cap cut off, you know, again, through no mistake on your part, and then become uninteresting to big public fund buyers.
You know, right.
They don't want to be more than a certain percentage of a company. Many of them can't be more than a certain percentage. And so they also are managing, you know, the Fidelities and the Capital Groups of the world. They're managing huge funds. And they also don't want to manage, I think, 100 different positions because they have to devote time and attention to each one of them. And so if your market cap is below a certain threshold and their minimum position size is above a certain threshold, but they can't be a 10% holder for a variety of SEC related reasons, they're just going to move on to something else. And you just lost a chance to have some buyer stock. And so you don't want to be in that box, which can happen on the downside if you're too small at the time of the IPO and too small by market cap, which is then a reflection of revenue.
Rich also had said that of the 1,200 companies that are unicorn companies now valued at $1 billion or more, that probably only 20% will go public in the next few years. I'm wondering if you agree with that number.
You know, I haven't put a percentage on it, but that seems like a reasonable one. They're definitely not, majority of them probably won't.
And what percentage do you think will just go out of business?
I think the go out of business is probably not that high, to be honest with you.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, total shutdowns happen, but they're actually kind of rare when you've gotten to that point, except companies probably raised in that last round a nine-figure amount of money. I do think that there will be some shutdowns. You know, the pizza robot one never made any sense
Zoom.
To me. Yeah, they probably made, they raised more than $100 million. I don't know if they got to a unicorn valuation, but you're going to see something like that where just there's not an exit at any price. I think some of these companies will probably quietly get acquired for a lot less than last round valuation, maybe somewhere between total capital raised in the last round. So that will happen, but probably not for a little while longer as they sort of work through what cash is left on their balance sheet. Complete Chapter 11, actually, I think is going to be a relatively small percentage. I'd call it less than 15% as total bankruptcy or whatever. And I think there will be more that sort of quietly get merged with some other entities.
Okay, last question. You mentioned Zoom. That company raised a ton of money from SoftBank. A number of companies that raised a ton of money from SoftBank have not done well. SoftBank seems like it's on the rise again, thanks to Arm. I'm wondering if in the market, what the perception is in terms of partnering with SoftBank. Is it toxic, or does Masayoshi-san seem again like a genius?
I have not had the pleasure of meeting Masa, and we've invested in this with SoftBank on a couple occasions, and those have been positive experiences. What I guess I would say about Masa is that he seems to be unafraid of volatility, and I wouldn't bet against him.
Probably smart. Anyway, great to talk to you. So nice to reconnect. And I'm hoping that I'm going to see you in a couple of months in London.
Well, thank you for the time. I would love to spend more time together, and let's definitely make that happen.
Thanks very much for listening. We look forward to seeing you back here soon. In the meantime, don't forget to check out our upcoming Strictly VC events in London in May and Washington, D.C. this June. Also, on April 25th in Boston, TechCrunch is hosting a Founder Summit to empower early-stage entrepreneurs from pre-seed to growth stages on their journey to success. You can find out more about all of these great events at techcrunch.com/events. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here soon.